You are listening to the Hike 80K Show. Welcome back to the Hike 80K Show, and it was a sunny day yesterday in the Adirondacks. Yep, no rain, and I'm not recording today from my attic. Today we're live with James Appleton in his shed quarters. What's up, James?
Good morning.
And speaking of the attic, thank you to everyone who submitted names for the idea of my studio space. We got some real contenders. For example, we have the Adicondack. Base Camp, the Loftitude Lounge, the Skylight Studio, the Summit. There was one that itched the right part of my brain. And from here on out, I think I might want to call the attic the Alpine Zone. Now, it doesn't have the word attic in it, but there's the Alpine Zone or the Alpine Attic, because what, the attic is at the highest part of the house, the Alpine Zone is at the highest part of the mountain. But I like how, you know, you have taken two words, wordplay, shed quarters.
Sure.
That I'm just trying to
I actually like the Alpine Zone.
I'm trying to be like you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I actually like the Alpine Zone. I think that's great because you can just say, like, I'm recording here at the Alpine Zone. It just becomes a thing.
The Alpine Zone attic.
Yeah.
The attic Alpine Zone. I don't know.
The Skylight Studio.
It's got a rudder.
Me too when you said that.
The Skylight Studio. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It sounds nice, but I'm not going to be there forever. I'm going to move out eventually. So it's got to be a temporary name. But, you know, it's got a weathered edge to it.
I like that. Yeah. A weathered edge. Good one.
But anyway, this episode is dropping the day before or on the day, depending if it's the 9th or the 10th, because I'm actually flying out to Ohio today for a few days. But the historic moment in Adirondack history, the 100th anniversary of the first completed finish of the 46 high peaks, that would be Bob George and Herbert Clark, who finished on Mount Emmons June 10th, 1925. And I wonder what they would have said if they even thought, man, what will this be like 100 years from today? Well, the answer is two guys recording a podcast talking about their moment.
Yes, and not just two guys recording a podcast talking about the moment. Other people who are planning to finish their 46 today on Emmons for that exact reason. People are literally following in their
footsteps. I wanted to go up there myself, but I'm going to be out of town.
Yeah, you're too busy going to the cornfields of Ohio. It's flat there. But yes, I know multiple people who are going up there today for this exact reason. And then you said someone else that
I would love to have gone up there. But you know, it's like I can celebrate that anytime. And I think what I want to do is we're gonna have a section in the podcast today that talks about their journey, and then as well as I'm gonna be putting a blog out on Hike 80K about their journey. And instead of the peak of the week today, that's what we're gonna be diving into. Is there the original trio? You know, they didn't just bag peaks; they built like this legacy. And so I want to share that with people. You know, and this podcast isn't all about the high peaks, but they're pretty cool to talk about.
You don't need to shy away from it. I know a lot of people think, oh, there's more to the Adirondacks. Yes, we get that, and it'll all be discussed, but we also don't have to shy away from the main attraction to the ADK park, which is the high peaks.
I mean, we're only four episodes in, and although the high peaks do have a lot of stuff to talk about, we only, you know, we totally love the other 95% of the park, and we do plan on diving deep into that as we progress this show. And of course, we've got some eye-opening wilderness rescues to talk about, some spicy hot takes, and of course, everyone's favorite, trailhead trivia at the end. Quick update on the Hike 80K launch. I just feel like people are starting to think that I'm actually never going to release this thing. But the simple thing is I have a third party who is working on the back end of getting my app submitted, and they're pretty slow to it. And so I think I'm going to take matters into my own hands here and try to just finish the submission process myself, because it's literally just a couple dumb things that need to be fixed that anyone can do. So I'm going to do that. And hopefully by the end of this week, Hike 80K will be here.
Awesome.
I know I said that 2 weeks ago. I said that a week ago. But it is what it is.
You're doing it, dude.
It's all right. We got time. And while the launch is huge, there's something even bigger in the works, bigger than Hike 80K.
Really?
Oh, I know. It's part of Hike 80K, but a super secret project that I'm starting to work on now behind the scenes, and I'm not talking about a merch shop, another merch shop or another guide. This is something so game changing that tens of thousands of hikers will use it. It's not launching yet. It's not coming anytime soon. But this past week, I blueprinted an idea, the future concept of Hike 80 came, what that's going to turn into. And I'm meeting with a large I'm just going to say they're developers of some sort in this field. I'm meeting with them on Tuesday via Zoom meeting, and we're going to talk about this feature and bringing together something that just does not exist here. Because I can hint at it a little bit. One of the biggest reasons why Hike 80K is existing is because every single extension of online stuff, period, whatever that is, whether it's a mobile app, you know, Strava, AllTrails, Instagram, and Facebook, Reddit, these are all the platforms that people are using to communicate and to talk with each other and learn. There is no centralized Adirondack community based, you know, there's the Adirondack forum, and then there's subreddits and stuff like this. But like, there's nothing that's actually like built by people from the Adirondacks for people of the Adirondacks. And so that's the reason why Hike 80K exists, because we want to bring everyone together and give them an actual centralized location where they can access everything and do everything that they need instead of having to go to all these other outside sources. And so it can be Adirondack driven, moderated, and built. And hopefully that will grow over time, especially with this concept, which is going to be a massive undertaking. But I've been rocking everything solo, and it's about time that I start delegating my efforts.
There you go. So version 2.0 is in the works before version 1.0 is launched. Spoken like a true creator. I can respect that.
I had no idea the timeline of this ultimate goal. I have to also paint the website in the way where people understand that this isn't just like the end product, what they're getting when it launches, but that there is a way that they can invest into it, which is giving back to themselves as well.
I think people will recognize things are going to grow. And again, I know you guys haven't seen this. I've seen the website. He has done a freaking fantastic job putting this stuff together. I'm very impressed with what the young lad has done.
Thank you.
Good stuff, but I'm also stoked that 2.0 is already on your radar, because that's kind of how I operate too.
So this also means, of course, I've mentioned it a few times, the massive giveaway is still on the horizon. It will be announced on our Instagram first at Hike80K. And remember, you don't need an Instagram to enter, as long as you're following us through our email as well. You can just go to our website, hike80k.com, right now, before it's live, and submit your email address to be part of the email chain. And that way you'll know when it launches. It's going to be everywhere. A guy asked me the other day, hey, can you let me know when Hike80K launches? And I was like, you won't be able to miss it. So yeah, if you got a story or a critique or something you want to just tell us, leave a comment wherever you're listening to us, or shoot us a note at contact@hike80k.com.
I'd love to know, we talked a little bit, but not really much. So the 46er banquet was last week. Last week? 2 weeks ago. No, last week.
No, it was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
Yep.
So 46ers were there. Obviously, it's the 46er banquet. You were there telling people about Hike 80K. You had a booth. I was there selling my books, doing all the things, talking to all the people. What was the consensus from actual 46ers about what you were doing? We didn't get to actually chat about
what I was doing. You mean at my table?
As far as Hike 80K goes, because I imagine this was new news to both of them.
Half of the people that approached me, if not more than half, already knew about it. They said they were following it on Instagram or something like that. And then I had the brochures there to kind of explain something to people, and they seemed pretty like
a warm welcome.
Yeah, they're like, wow, this is great. This is cool. And they're just like, well, good luck with your venture, and maybe we'll be a part of it. So I think just a lot of people are kind of like, oh, well, I don't really know what this is. I'll check it out.
I get it.
See what it, if it's something that I need. And, not everyone's going to need this.
Sure. Well, at the same time, though, based on what I've seen from what you've done already, like, if that existed when I was doing the 46, it would have been so ridiculously helpful. So.
Sure. And it's more than just
and I also know about I know what you've done, so it's easy for me to say
sure
it will work, but whereas they don't really have that context, so right. I get it, but I'm glad it was it wasn't met with like, what are you doing,
right?
Because there's this weird energy and vibe about some people about whenever you do anything involving the Adirondacks, people are very sensitive to it. They're very like, they don't want it to be tarnished in a weird way. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember when I first launched the podcast, I had the same kind of vibe from some people, very few, but like, obviously some people take that sort of weird ownership over the park, ownership in a bad way. A lot of people take ownership in a great way, which I appreciate, but you know, people are sensitive to anything about doing something about the ADK.
Right. Well, the mobile app is super exciting to me because it's something like right at your fingertips. You're going to have access to everything that you're going to a million different places for, and it's going to be right there. So long term, it's going to be a lot of things. To start with, it's going to be just, you know, the basics. You're going to have the community. You're going to be able to dive in with each other, explore the guides. I mean, you'll even have the Hike ADK SMS system, which is going to be the first time, first ever alert system for trail conditions for people who want to sign up completely free. And you'll get alerts if there's high water, deep snow, last minute, you weren't, you know, aware about, just stuff as locals who live here, who can actually be here consistently to observe weather patterns and see what's happening, to get notified immediately for those who might be going out to have any last minute changes. And, you know, you even got little things like the white base webcam right there. Boom, open the app. What does it look like on the top of a high peak right now? You know, but there'll be other features that will be implemented over time.
For everybody at work, like you're in New York City working in your building, no windows because most of the people don't have windows where their office is. They can just put their phone, put it on do not disturb, put the phone on their desk with the white face camera on and just
And it updates. Well, and you can do this on the website as well. So you could do it on an extra monitor.
It's just quick and simple though. Convenient.
Yeah, just right there. You know, because whenever I have to go look at it, I just go to Google, type in white face webcam, to the website, look it up. But this will just be right there on the app. So, all right, let's talk trail. I would consider that spring is over, even though it's not officially summer according to the solstice, but I feel like we've graduated the summer here. You know, would you agree?
I, in my mind, summer in the Adirondacks begins June 1st.
Yep.
May is the month of spring. April is the next month is May. Spring starts next month. Maybe we'll get some bonus spring-like temperatures occasionally in April. Spring is my, and then June 1st, it's just full-fledged summer. It's too short here to just wait till July. You know,
the snow's gone.
Snow's going to be back in October, so it's only a few months away till snow comes back. So,
once it's wet, rocky, rooty, and muddy, it's summer.
Like always, but yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no snow or ice, you know?
Yes, I agree.
That's how we like it. I like that. Every single day people are hitting the high peaks, early morning sunset missions, overnights, it's all happening. And all the snow is gone. I had a couple friends yesterday go up to Marcy though and hit the Marcy snowfield. It's still holding really well. I think it's going to be there depending on how much rain and heat we get. I think there will still be some snow there going into July. But they've been skiing it and that's pretty fun. Did you see that on my story? The helicopter and them skiing, the Apache was doing a low fly pass over Marcy as they were skiing down the snowfield at the same time.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see it though. That's fantastic. This was yesterday?
Well, that one was a couple days ago. Okay. But I put Cadence Clearwater over the
nice recall.
Yeah. So sunrises are now at 5:12 in the morning and sunsets are at 8:36. So you got plenty of daylight.
Best time of the year.
That doesn't excuse you to not bring a headlamp though. So always pack one. And although it's not raining as much, the last few weeks have been a nonstop rotation of like fog, drizzle, and a terrible smoke, wildfire smoke. But real talk, James, how come you haven't been in the high peaks lately?
It's a great question.
They're right outside. Just, you know how many people listening to this just wish they could just do that?
Just haven't been. I haven't been up high peaks since I did Cascade a few weeks ago with the Cascade Great Range Athlete Team, so it's been a hot second.
To give you credit, you just completed the Lake Placid Half Marathon.
Yeah,
right. Yesterday, I saw you drive past my house. I just got to sit on my porch and watch every person run by. I had no idea who was running it. People were just like, "Hey, Jonathan." I'm like, "Oh, hey."
It's funny because as I was running down that road, it didn't even occur to me, but I was like, "Oh wait, Jonathan lives on this road." And literally at that moment is when I turned right and saw you. It just happened to pop in my head as I was literally at your house.
Dope pic of you if like I knew you were going to be out there.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good, great day. Sun was out. Weather was absolutely perfect. We also had a helicopter fly over when they started the race, which was super cool.
Yeah, I got a video of that.
Nice.
The same Apache that flies over Mercy.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah,
it was
I don't cool know if it's legal, but it is cool. It's America.
Yeah, dude, come on. It's a U.S. Army helicopter. They're gonna do what they're gonna do.
I did get out recently. I went up Cascade via the new trail to scout things out. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. because I want to talk about that in the news. But I'll return to that because there's some cool things there. And I got a couple things lined up. I'm heading out to Maine in a few weeks. Sarah's never been out there. We got I got a family vacation down in Speculator, the good old camp of the woods, here in a couple weeks as well. But I'm going to Ohio right after we record this. So a little bit of traveling.
I'll be in the high peaks plenty. I have plenty of hikes on the calendar already for the summer. Yeah, plenty of hikes from guiding to group hikes to places I want to go that don't involve mountains. So yeah, we'll be getting out. It's been terrible. I mean, it's been absolutely terrible. We've had rain every day for the last year of my life. So, you know, we'll get out.
All right, well, let's get into the Ranger reports. It was a pretty busy schedule, or not schedule, it's all unscheduled, but it was a really busy report last week. We're starting off with the incident that I did talk about previously on Street and Nye, but now that it's officially out, I can give a little bit more information. So on May 27th, which was, you know, a couple weeks ago at this point, but a 26-year-old hiker broke her leg in multiple places, about a mile past Indian Pass Brook, so probably about halfway up the mountain. So 8 forest rangers and a paramedic responded. They reached the patient at 9 p.m., stabilized her leg and carried her out using the backpack litter system. It was 3 miles, give or take, to get them out on the terrain, and it lasted until 3 a.m.
Brutal. Did the article say how? Like, did she slip? Did she fall?
I don't know, but broken in multiple places.
Yeah, that's intense.
I don't know. It makes me cringe. So, meanwhile, in Indian Lake, on the same day, rangers were called to Lake Durant Campground to assist with an eviction. Campers had caused a major disturbance that night before. 7 tickets were issued for violations, including underage alcohol possession, leaving a fire unattended, and the rangers remained on site until the group cleared and cleaned the area and were told to go home.
All right, there we go. Lake Durant Campground, too, if you've never been, great spot. Definitely a great place to go camp. I've never camped there, but I've walked through it on the NPT, and we had made reservations last summer that we unfortunately had to cancel, but it was impactful when we went there, and I wanted to go back and camp there for the weekend. But it is a great campground. Highly recommend.
Well, the next day, in Little Tupper Lake area, a rescue unfolded where an inflatable boat carrying 3 campers from New Jersey was punctured. 2 of them became stranded on the North Shore, and rangers bushwhacked to reach the site and learned a 3rd person had attempted to paddle to their campsite before vanishing. A drone search and ground teams were deployed. Hours later, the missing camper was found disoriented but safe, and after being picked up by a Good Samaritan and dropped off at the trailhead.
Well, there we go.
They were probably from Jersey too. Oh no, they were from Jersey. I just read that. Wait, does that, man, were they both people from Jersey? Oh, I don't even know. All right, anyway. Then the day after that, the rangers assisted a 52-year-old hiker who had gone off the trail in Mount Joe.
I saw that.
I lost Mount Joe.
I was very confused about that.
They were able to guide them back on the path. I have seen people take, like, there are spur trails and stuff.
Yeah, I have an idea as to probably which trail they took.
It could have been the new trail too.
Yeah, the new trail has that one kind of trail off to the right off of it, but I feel like of all the trails on Mount Joe, the actual trails are so evident.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And then finally, the day after that, 2 hikers, so this is May 31st, 2 hikers were stranded on the Roaring Brook Trail going up and down Giant after a rising stream made it too dangerous to cross. So rangers hiked in, helped them safely navigate the brook and escort them back to the trailhead. Now, if you've ever done the Roaring Brook Trail, there is a river crossing, a pretty major one, and it flows. You have to cross it right before or right at the Roaring Brook Falls itself. So you have to cross it there. And it never posed an obstacle to me, but I don't know. It's not that big.
I've only been up Roaring Brook once. I always go up the Ridge Trail.
Yes.
I've only been up it once, so it wasn't an issue. And I actually quite honestly found it a little underwhelming compared to what I feel like the Ridge Trail offers. So that tends to be my go-to spot.
Cool. Well, we're going to hop into news next. All right. story. I said I was going to talk about the Cascade Mountain Trail. I felt that this was newsworthy. I went up and took a ton of pictures, talked to them for a while, and I even did an anonymous interview with one of the lead project managers. And I'm going to put a blog out on Hike80K about that as well here recently. But for those who are interested to know, the trail is about 90% of the way done. I know that sounds like a lot, but to be honest, that's a deceiving mile because I think they've only made about a quarter mile of progress in the last 2 years. So I went up and I was like, man, I can't wait to see how far up ahead they are. And then I got to the spot and I'm like, okay, cool, trail's done. Let's keep going. And then it was about a quarter mile up that they were working. And I thought that was pretty wild. There's only four of them. And last time I was there was only four of them. So I think there's like 4 to 6 people at a time working on the trail. And because of the insane system that they're using to build it, like, they customized and built from scratch, Tick Hunters built from scratch this system on how to build this trail specifically. And I think they wanted to at least use it as a testing point to see, like, well, okay, how long does this trail last? How does it hold up? How long does it take to build? How much does it cost? Because realistically, they're not going to be using the same method to build probably any other trail in the Adirondacks. I think if you took like a trail crew from like a national park, they would have built this thing in like 10 weeks. I don't even know. But it was carved out all the way to the top. And then eventually the flagging, there was flagging and they just cut back trees and stuff like that. So it's marked all the way. But from what they told me, the trail is, they're going to change the process just a little bit as they get higher up. They're going to kind of speed it up, I guess, and have a little less attention to detail. I don't know exactly what that means, but I think they're going to just try to get it done essentially. And it still probably looks like a 2026 release at this point. So I'll be putting out a blog on that to go into detail about the whole thing if you're interested to hear more about that.
And this is making Cascade like a 7-mile hike now, right? Each way?
11.
Oh, it's 11-mile total round trip?
Yeah. So like 5.5.
Yeah, so Cascade is no longer going to be thought of as that, like, quote, beginner high peak, even though it should never have been thought of that.
It's just such a nice trail, though.
For miles.
It will be easy in spite of the distance. Mm-hmm. It will be the easiest 10 miles anywhere.
Still, 11 miles is 11 miles, whether you're walking down the street or you're walking in the woods. So it's Cascade is not going to have that same reputation anymore.
Yeah, and my understanding is they're going to block off the parking lots similarly to how they blocked off all the parking near the AMR. They're going to put up posts and then brush in the trail and try to deter people from it.
Now, what is the vibe for pitch off being right there, though?
Don't know.
Because you could just park right there.
Good luck. Yeah. Maybe the East Trail will become the new thing.
Yeah, it might, which is even smaller, even less parking. But yeah, ultimately, it seems strange to me if they're going to block off parking, but there's an entirely other trail there for an entirely different mountain across the street. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But yeah, new trail.
Sure. Well, you remember in our last episode together, I talked about Whitney Park going up for sale. It was 36,000 acres going up for sale for $125 million. Well, on June 2nd, Sean Todd, a Dallas, Texas based luxury developer, quietly signed contract to acquire the entire property for the $125 million plus the adjacent Caddy Hill mansion for another $12.9 million. So Todd, known for high-end real estate ventures, including boutique, golf resorts, and Michelin-caliber restaurants, claimed he'll apply a light touch here, developing only maybe 1,000 to 1,500 acres and leaving the rest untouched. But there's a twist, and it sparked outrage. New York State wasn't allowed to bid at all because the late John Hendrickson's estate included a deed restriction that explicitly barred any state acquisition, cutting off the possibility of turning Whitney Park into a public wilderness. So he made it where New York State can't do anything to his property, which I didn't even know that's something you could do. It's within the state. Can't the state even do eminent domain if they wanted to? But instead, the full net proceeds from the sale will go directly into the town of Long Lake, which has a population of under 800. So town officials were reportedly blindsided but optimistic, already discussing how to manage what could be generational windfall through a permanent trust. Locals see opportunity for housing support, business investments, tax relief, and scholarships. But there are many, many split reactions, as you could probably imagine. So some see economic hope, lodging and hospitality jobs, a stable tax base, and a revitalized community backed by private wealth. But others argue that this is just another playground for the ultra-rich, a luxury bubble that will fragment wilderness and push out working families, just like what happened in Lake Placid, you know, way back in the day. There's also a tension between preservation and production. Conservationists want easements and corridor protections. Foresters and industrial workers argue that state ownership kills jobs and removes productive forest land from use. And locals from logging families say private ownership like this has actually protected Whitney better than some forest preserve lands have in the past. So,
well, there you go.
There is a mix. And then there's the tax myth debate that some commenters believe that state acquisition would drain local revenue. Others rightly counter that New York State pays full market value property tax in perpetuity. And while Todd says he's open to the partnerships with conservation groups, skeptics aren't convinced. So one user put it bluntly, it's a developer. Come on. Another commented, this is a paradise lost again. On the flip side, some longtime Long Lakers are pretty happy. For them, it's not just about politics. It's about finally having a shot at economic security and keeping the land under local stewardship, not a bureaucracy. So it sounds like there's good intentions by this Todd guy. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, I've never been in that work. I have a couple friends. Well, one main guy who was, I'm pretty close to one of the guys who was a large acquirer of Big Tupper and many other plots of land out there. And so talking with him and seeing their mindset, I know when people say they like this place and they see the vision of it, I do think there's a fine line between preserving the land and incorporating economic boost. And with him saying he only wants to develop 1,000 acres of it with the intention of preserving the rest of the land, and that, who knows, with the bureaucracy of New York State, how they might restrict the land. And because sometimes the way that they want to protect wilderness isn't always the most free, you know, because there's a difference between wilderness and wildness, and that the way they protect wilderness doesn't always translate into wildness. It just feels more restrictive sometimes.
Well said. Well said. So, I guess for me, my whole vibe goes back to the Adirondack Park isn't the Adirondack Park without the infrastructure of business and people who live here that bring people up here. So if the entire land is solely like a playground for the people who come up here once a week, once a year, every few weeks just to go play for a day and then go home, it doesn't allow the towns to succeed and the towns to thrive. So quite frankly, I'm going to default to what is going to allow the communities and the area to keep moving forward, because as we all know, the Adirondack Park, the towns here are just like a bad year away from not existing at all times. So for me, that's kind of where my brain is always going to, is what needs to happen so that the towns, the communities can thrive, which will then allow the people who want to come up here and play to have somewhere to go so they can have their fun and they can thrive, and then everybody wins together. That's kind of where I'm always going to default to. So for me, I hear that story and I just say, all right, time will tell. I'm just like here to watch. We'll see what happens. Obviously, yep. I have no stake or input in what's going on, but I'm here to watch the show. It'd be great to see Long Lake thrive and have some more infrastructure and have some more jobs and some more communities and some more, you know, people living there full time. Like, obviously, that's what I want to see. But I come at this whole subject as somebody who obviously lives here, so I'm going to come at it from that perspective.
Did you hear about the moose on Goodman Mountain? It's been all over.
I saw a picture.
You might have saw one, but
saw a picture
that translated into a massive viral movement, and hundreds of people apparently flocked to Goodman Mountain because this moose was hanging around there. So a bull moose has been lingering near the summit for a couple weeks, and including a lot of like school field trips, even.
Oh, geez,
like,
stuff Louise. Like this.
Yeah. So that came to a halt because the DEC officially closed the Goodman Mountain Trail this past week, citing safety concerns for both people and the moose. Rangers are enforcing the closure. Signs are posted, and wildlife experts are monitoring the situation. So it's just there. It's chilling. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen pictures of it, it's a really funny looking moose. It's not even pretty.
Yeah, I did
looking.
See a picture. That's all I saw. I didn't like look into the story itself. Just saw moose in the woods, and I think, okay, cool.
So I just didn't realize. I thought it was just a passing by thing, but apparently it's just been chilling and hanging out there. So I don't know. I mean, if I want to see a moose, I'm not going to flock to where I know there is one, because then that's just cheating the system. Mm. I want to be able to just like be out there unexpected and it comes along my way. I don't want to have to go seek the elusive moose. I want the elusive moose to come find me.
It's very selfish of you to not put in the work to go see the moose. No. But I understand what you're saying. Also, dude, you're never going to see a moose in this park. You're just never going to. If you see a moose, my God, are you the luckiest person?
I've seen about 20 moose tracings.
Oh, walk on the NPT, you're going to like, see a lot of moose.
I know I've walked in their paths.
Yes.
I'm like, man,
I've never even seen a darn black bear on the trail in the woods, let alone going to see a moose. So once again, you see a moose, you are so lucky.
Yeah, so that's been interesting. I don't know. I've never seen that before. All right, well, that's the news. And up next, we're going to get into one of the primary stories of the episode. This section would normally be peak of the week, but I thought I would take a moment to share the story of Bob Marshall, George Marshall, and Herbert Clark, because many of them just see, I don't know, Bob Marshall. Oh, hey, these are the first 46ers. Cool stuff. But their journey of becoming a 46er is different than anyone else's. It's June 10th, 1925. The clouds break slowly atop Mount Emmons, casting a pale golden hue through dense spruce thickets. Three men, two brothers, and their steadfast guide stand quietly, probably breathing heavily, their breaths crystallizing in the crisp Adirondack air. There is no triumphant summit sign, no cheering crowd, only the profound silence of wilderness and the breeze, and a place that few before them had ever ventured up to. In fact, no one to that day has ever stood on the summit or high point of this mountain. Yet this quiet, wooded summit marked a monumental achievement. Bob and George Marshall and their guide, Herbert Clark, had become the first to hike all 46 Adirondack High Peaks. The moment was humble, deeply felt, and unknowingly historic. Their journey began innocently enough in the summer of 1916. Teenagers Bob and George stood atop Ampersand Mountain when they were just teenagers, like 13 to 16 years old, gazing across the sea of peaks. And if you've ever been on Ampersand, you're looking out to the sewers. They're actually looking at their finish, if you think about it. Back home in New York City, winter evenings were spent immersed in Verplank Colvin's detailed survey maps, meticulously cataloging each Adirondack peak over 4,000 feet, driven by a youthful exuberance and boundless curiosity. Bob Marshall's relentless energy became legendary. He was described as a hyperactive and obsessive person, and he meticulously recorded every summit, every wildlife sighting, every unnamed pond. And I wish the surveyors before him did that too, because there's a lot of unknown things that Colvin and Emmons encountered when they were doing their first stuff. They leave stuff out. Like, I don't know if you've ever read like Emmons' report of going up Nippletop for the first time. His journey between the start at Elk Lake to the summit of Nippletop is nothing but like, yep, I ventured that way, went through Gorge of the Dial, it was thick, it was cliffy, went up the southwest flank of this, and got to the top of Nippletop. And I'm like, dude, I mean, maybe that's all there was to write about.
As somebody who has also chronicled their entire Adirondack 46er journey in detail on both my podcast and in my book, it's hard to remember every single detail. Mm. But, you know, and I guess you'd be surprised how many details you do remember. Yes, I'm saying. You do surprise yourself how many details you do remember when you put your brain back in there. But I can relate to trying to make sure you don't miss anything, and just you're going to miss some details that other people wouldn't have.
So younger brother George matched this intensity with quiet resolve, steadfastly supporting their ambitious goals. Their guide, Herbert Clark, who's a lot older than them, affectionately called Uncle Herb, provided essential wisdom, guiding the boys through dense wilderness with quiet humor and unshakable calm. Their first official high peak climb was Whiteface in August of 1918, which I believe was 100 years from when I finished, because I finished my 46 journey on Whiteface in 2018. Though that mountain was accessible, it didn't actually have a road up there at the time. But it set the tone for more challenging and remote adventures ahead. As their list of peaks grew, so did the physical and emotional demands. Without marked trails, they navigated by compass and instinct. slicing through dense spruce and marshlands in heavy wool clothing and rugged leather boots. Bob wrote of such nights camped beside untouched beaver ponds, marveling, quote, "It seemed hardly possible that I was in the crowded Empire State of today." Because even back then, New York State was hustling and bustling.
Yeah, not much has changed. Not much has changed.
It's true. The rugged terrain and lack of trails often pushed them to the limits. Peaks like Cuxicraga, which back then I believe would have been named Cold River Mountain, and Allen became infamous among their accounts for testing endurance and patience. In 1921, an ambitious but confused expedition into the remote Seward Range to go get Donaldson and Seward resulted in a critical oversight. They missed the true summit of Emmons at the time as well. And so it would have been 4 long years until they returned to correct that mistake. Their decision-making process behind certain peaks was also not without controversy. For example, Great Peak originally excluded because they knew it didn't meet the prominence, was in fact included at an urging of Russell Carson, who valued historical significance over strict topographic criteria. Similarly, peaks later confirmed under 4,000 feet, Blake, Cliff, and Cuxicraga remained on the list of tradition and relevance for their original endeavors. So they knew knowingly these mountains didn't fit. And Gray Peak, I think it only has 136 feet in prominence. And they also, I think it was Bob Marshall's least favorite mountain, just because it's the highest point in the high peaks without a bald summit. And so the spruce is just absolutely like mind-meltingly thick, especially back then. And it's named after botanist Asa Gray. That was the significance of the person. So each ascent carried both hardship and revelation. Bob's journal vividly recounts difficult climbs marked by exhaustion and scratched limbs. Yet, even amidst frustration, reaching the summit was always transformative. On Mount Haystack, he famously wrote, "From Haystack, you can look over thousands and thousands of acres, unblemished by the works of men, perfect as made by nature." These profound moments anchored their adventure, elevating it beyond mere peak bagging to something deeply spiritual. The trio's journey concluded quietly atop Emmons on June 10th, 1925, yet the echoes of their accomplishment resonated widely. Inspired by Bob's descriptive pamphlet, The High Peaks of the Adirondacks, published by the Adirondack Mountain Club, subsequent generations formed the Adirondack 46ers. Herb Clark was honored as the first 46er, Bob, number two, and George, number three, a fitting tribute to their pioneering spirit. Today, there is now over 16,000 people who call them 46ers recorded, probably close to 20,000 total, of including people who've done it without registering, transforming once solitary trails into bustling avenues. Sometimes, mainly on weekends. But this increased popularity brings inevitable scrutiny. Critics argue that the Marshall's legacy has inadvertently led to, quote, overcrowding, environmental degradation, and unstable strain on wilderness resources. Indeed, the trails bear the scars of overuse and erosion in these, you know, small fine lines off the mountain. Habitat disruption has been seen, and summit congestion is definitely abundant. However, I would say the habitat disruption isn't necessarily from hikers as much as it was from the logging to follow and how that drove things out. And we've done a good job of bringing wildlife back into the area, because moose didn't even exist 100 years. I think when Bob was out there 100 years ago, moose didn't exist. There was not a single trace of it, but they naturally repopulated the area. Even these of these concerns might be valid, there remains a compelling counterpoint. This attention fuels conservation efforts, educational initiatives, and community stewardship. Advocates emphasize today that experiencing wilderness firsthand fosters essential awareness and advocacy for its preservation. And there's plenty of volunteer groups funded by trail restoration, the Summit Steward programs. And, you know, there's obviously all these intentions of protecting the land. But that's, you know, when I go back to the wilderness versus wildness. And I do know that there is a big difference. I wrote about it in my guidebook, because you can have wilderness, which is pretty much a restriction, but then there's wildness with how is it preserved, the actual idea of preserving it. And this controversy persists. So some argue passionately that the popularity of the high peaks has irreversibly damaged the very wilderness Bob Marshall sought to protect, and trailhead parking, you know, overflows and the human waste issues intensify and the quiet moments of solitude cherished by early adventurers becomes increasingly rare. Yet the benefits cannot be overlooked. Thousands of people, just like you and I, have never understood or valued wilderness in the way we probably did before we hiked. And we're experiencing firsthand the unmatched beauty of the Adirondacks, even today, 100 years later. We can still sense it and see it. The Marshall's enduring legacy serves as a powerful reminder of our delicate balance with nature. And the Adirondack 46ers have evolved from a mere hikers to a fierce protectors, ensuring these majestic mountains remain forever wild, because they raise a ton of money and they do so much work. If you want to know a community and a place to get plugged into that does a lot of good trail work and they put money into the right things, check out the Adirondack 46ers, because they're more than just peak baggers. So in the end, Bob Marshall's words still echo truest. From Haystack, you can look over the thousands of acres unblemished by the works of men. Their journey wasn't just about climbing, it was about awakening. Today, amid the crowds and the controversy, that same spark survives. And if we're willing to listen to the mountains and to the silence, they still have much to teach us.
Awesome, awesome story. Inspirational and incredibly life-changing for thousands of people that they had no idea that were going, people who are going to follow in their footsteps, who are going to go through a journey that was going to transform their very lives the same way it transformed theirs. So I think, to me, that's where my brain goes to. It's like, man, they didn't know what they were actually doing. They were going out to have the new adventure, see the mountains, but the ripple effect of that adventure for, you know, thousands of people that came after them who have been transformed because of these mountains, to me, is that's the big story that is just absolutely fascinating. The mountains are awesome.
Yeah, I love their story, and I just wish I could, you know, I really want to make a short film on, like, two period of some of their adventures and finishes. And I don't know, it's like, I thought about it, and man, even though the Adirondacks aren't known, really known, like, nationally or even internationally, I think there are some hidden stories and things here that could make a super amazing Netflix series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have the backdrop of absolute rugged wilderness, so it kind of draws a lot of people in.
I think it could make for an amazing movie, without even having to understand, like, what the Adirondacks are. I think
you like rugged wilderness, so you'll be drawn to it. Like, if you were to watch a movie that took place in Canada and took place in the Rockies, like, you'd still enjoy it because it's of where it is, what it is representing, yeah. Being in the wilderness. This would be no different.
All right, with that, we're going to go into one of the main subjects next, and I know this is going to be an interesting one to talk about. Hiking solo. All right, I want to talk about this subject because for some reason, it always gets overly scrutinized. It stirs up debate and it brings out the critics. And honestly, I'm not really sure why, because I think there is, in fact, a right answer. I think there's definitely opinions on how to do it right or why certain people don't like to do it themselves. But in terms of what's right and wrong for a person, dude, hike your own hike. Don't be dumb. Now, I know that simple phrase doesn't really translate to a lot of people, and that's because they might just not have that knowledge or common sense of how to recreate out here specifically. And of course, this isn't just a problem in the Adirondacks. It's even a problem in the streets of New York City. So, and it's anywhere, right? People can get lost all the time. And no matter how much you advocate hiking solo or hiking with people, people are going to get lost. People are going to do dumb things, and people aren't even dumb, and they go out and things happen to them, right? All the time.
What is the argument right now? Is the argument here that I know this has been like a subject of conversation lately. Are people arguing that you should not be ever hiking by yourself? Is that what's happening right
so
now?
Every single time someone unfortunately dies,
yeah,
or gets rescued in the backcountry because they were solo,
sure,
you suddenly hear this course people saying, well, that's what happens when you hike alone. And I think this whole, you know, what happened with Leo over winter, yeah. And just even recent developments just all over the Rangers of people hiking solo, it's always on people's minds. And it's like, wow, it's given the Rangers things to do. But it's like,
I actually have, I mean, hiking solo, I hike solo all the time. So obviously I'm going to say there's nothing wrong with hiking solo. But I will say, I don't winter hike in the high peaks solo for the reason that things in the winter, again, are so much different. One thing goes wrong, you're by yourself, you're in trouble. It's a big difference in July than it is in January. Mm. So to me, I actually see a difference between the two. I would not recommend people going solo, but at the same time, do what you're going to do. You know, hiking is an inherently risky activity.
Mm-hmm.
It is not like sitting on your couch. You know what you're getting yourself into. So actually be prepared. That's why I say
that's why you wrote a book. That's why I wrote a book. That's why I'm producing Hike 80K, because people are going to hike solo. People need to know what they're 100%. Doing. You know, so I think we all have a duty to help each other but you also need to be willing to be helped and educated.
And you know, dude, you know right off the bat, if you go out by yourself, you're on your own. You're making a risky activity riskier, and you're weighing the pros and cons and the risks and the rewards, and you're going. Like, you're making the decision. The whole idea of changing the game or saying that people shouldn't ever do that is, you know, come on. We don't need to change everything because this mm-hmm. happened here, this happened there. But knowing the risks in the winter, in January, the risk is way higher than it is in July.
For sure.
So it's like each person needs to determine at which point the risk is not worth the reward. So for me, as I said, like, I don't high peak hike in the winter. I mean, I've gone up Cascade and Porter many times in the winter by myself for like a sunrise or something, but big difference between going to Allen and going to Cascade and Porter solo in the middle of the
people
winter.
People translate though. They're like, oh, I hiked up Street and I solo just fine. I can do anything else solo. But it's not the same. It really
it's
isn't.
Not the same. And you have to weigh the risk. At what point for you is the risk higher than the reward?
But
for
people don't know that until they go out on hike solo and mess up.
Yeah, right. I know. But at the same time, you know, podcasts like yours, podcasts like mine, books, stories, people's opinions, etc. That is why it is valid to hear from people who have the experience, who have done the things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, too, hiking brings out like an ego in people a lot. Like, look at me, I can do this. I've done this one time and it was fine. But it's like, let's take the gentleman. What was it, 3 years ago? The guy that died on the trap dike in the winter mm-hmm. from the avalanche. Was it 3 years ago? 4 years
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, I think it was three winters now.
Hadn't he hiked like some of the tallest mountains?
He was
Everest.
Working on the seven summits
he
of
was
the world.
So experienced. And he was climbing the trap dike. We had a bad snowstorm that day and he died in an avalanche. So just because you have the experience, once again, is why I say the mountains don't care about you. Things can happen out there and you have to be prepared for that, but you have to weigh the risk versus the reward mm-hmm. ratio. And it's going to be different for every person. This person may never want to go out there and they're not going to. Whereas this person, they're going to risk a lot more. That's just what's going to happen. That's life.
I don't think this quote unquote debate is going to change anything. I think I think it's just going to cause you to go in circles. I think you are still entitled to your own opinion. And when I say that there is a right or wrong answer, that there is a correct answer, what I'm saying, the correct answer is people are going to hike solo, get over it, because a majority of the people who are hiking solo are probably fine to hike solo. You can't just take, 1% just because 1% is not even that much of people, because hiking solo, if they weren't hiking solo, could have avoided something, means that then all of hiking solo is bad. So a lot of people listening to this right now probably hike solo. Now, I have hiked probably over 80% of my entire hiking career solo. But I'm going to be honest, it's not because I prefer that. If there's someone that comes alongside of me who's able to keep up, they like the same things, like they want to go out and do this together, I welcome it every time. There is never a time where I'm like, no, I just want to go by myself. And now I'm not saying I accept every single time someone says, hey, let's go hike together. It's only when I am still able to enjoy it at my desire and my speed, we're on the same page mentally, right? When I do that, I'm all for it, especially mm-hmm. if I'm comfortable with them conversationally. Mm-hmm. I like that. If we're on the same, even gritters, I don't need to go run, but if I need to go bag all four Seward Peaks, I don't want to go with someone that's going to keep me out there for 14 hours. I want to get that stuff done in under 10 hours because I can, and I know the paths well, and I don't want to have to babysit. So I don't prefer to go solo, but because of the nature of what I do and who I am and my schedule, because I'm on the weekdays out pretty much, it could be any day of the week. It's just the nature of me. And so I need to make sure that like I have checked all of my resources. You know, people know where I'm going. I know where I'm going. And I never like going to new places by myself. Now, there is not a lot of new places that I haven't been to in the High Peaks region specifically. But if I'm going to venture, do overnights, I hate camping alone. I don't ever like, I never will camp alone. And if I'm going on any place like outside of the High Peaks, if it's a far thing, I would prefer to go with people unless it's something super short, like a fire tower or something like that. Like, yeah, I'll go solo, but I just don't like new experiences solo. No one's willing to wake up at 2 a.m. and chase a sunrise or hammer out 20 miles. Like
very few people. There's a certain crowd that'll wake up at that hour to go out and start early. Yeah. But I completely second everything you said about that. Hiking is like it's not just like having a conversation. It's not like meeting someone for coffee. You're out there for the entire day. There's so many factors at play. You don't want to be setting yourself up for an unsuccessful day in the woods if you don't have to. And when you go out with someone, let's say someone you don't know, there's a lot of unknown factors that you are now taking on for yourself to go into a place like the backcountry where things can go wrong really quickly. So the whole idea of like hiking with anybody without doing some vetting, I actually think is almost riskier than going solo sometimes, quite frankly, because you're now, whether you want to or not, you're in charge of another person as well. And that person is also in charge of you. So for example, when I go, if I guide someone, I go through the map with them. I go through like, all right, these are the trails. This is what we're going to do. Here, we're going to turn here. There, we're going to go there. We're going to go from, because if something happens to me, I'm now like they have to help me now. You know what I mean? So it can somewhat times be riskier going with somebody new.
Now, I do think people who are completely against solo hiking or the people who just scrutinize people for doing it or they think that it's dumb, I think they also fall into the same category of, so they're going to be the same kind of person who, when someone says, hey, I'm going to go do 8 high peaks in a day, they say, yeah, well, that's the second one. But I was going to say, like, people are saying, like, hey, I want to go do this loop. I want to go hit the McIntyre Range and Mount Marcy in the same day. And people are like, you're dumb. You're going to need to get rescued. Sure. And they're just like, dude, like, are you kidding me?
People are very,
they're judging what other people else are going to do just because it's something that they wouldn't do. And like,
they're very predictable.
Like what you said about the fast. Like, so what? I want to, I've been up this mountain 30 times. Let me do what I want to do. It's how I am loving and experiencing the wilderness myself. And I'm just because you don't like running and you don't want to rush doesn't mean that I am not loving this as much as you or in the same way as you. Like, I'm out there just going fast. I don't want to spend 14 hours on a trail. Like, I want to get back, you know? So,
yes, I am the first person that wants the day to be as short as possible.
Do you remember your first, let's say, substantial solo hike?
Yeah. My first solo hike that was like nerve wracking, I think it was High Peaks, maybe like 6 and 7. Maybe it was like 8 or 9. It was Street and I. And that was nerve wracking for just like the first idea of being on a quote herd path, a quote trailless peak solo. But the first big solo day was Dial Nippletop Blake and Colvin. That was my first like, okay, I can do this big day by myself thing. So I remember the nerves of that day big time.
I think I did almost every single high peak of my 46 journey with someone. I did Street and I, Tabletop and Phelps solo. But I'm trying to think back in my mind. I think that might have been it.
I'm probably half.
It wasn't until I moved here that I started doing bigger stuff by myself, but I already knew the peaks pretty well and I was starting to run. I did my first 46 unsupported attempt and I was out solo overnight camping and stuff like that, which was definitely a daunting experience for me. But I felt pretty confident. I never felt scared until, you know, cryptic things started happening to me in the woods and I was all alone and had no place to go. I had no car. I had no service. All I had was my SOS beacon and my mind.
You can hear all about those attempts on the 46 to 46 podcast. We did an episode, I think, for every one of your
FPT attempts. Yeah, a while back. And
yeah, they're a few years old at this point.
Yeah, I probably had a higher voice back then too.
Yeah, most definitely. It was a good time though. And if you haven't heard the 46 to 46 podcast episode called 25 High Peaks in 25 Hours, I think is what it was, or 25 in 25, that's Jonathan. You did what was it? Was it 25 high peaks in 25 hours?
Right. So, but the main thing.
Great episode. Great story.
If you're one of the picky people that's like, well, okay, but how many did you do in 24 hours?
Yeah.
It was 24.
And those people are the same people that are probably telling you to, you're going to get rescued. Why are you doing the 10 high peaks in a day? Whatever. Doesn't make a difference. Everyone's going to hike their own hike. You just have to know your risk, know what you're willing to risk, and accept what you're willing to risk. Accept the consequences of the risk that you're willing to do. But again, everything is pros and cons. Mm-hmm. You could go out hiking with someone and all of a sudden, and it turns out you don't really know this person. You put yourself at a worse, at a riskier place because you don't know enough about them. In fact, I would dare say, because people go hiking with new people all the time, it's like worse than a first date because you're putting yourselves in situations that could literally kill you. Mm-hmm. And you could be in that situation because of a stranger. So,
right.
Is it really, this would have been actually, now that we think about it, this would actually been a great debate is which is riskier, going solo or going with someone else. Like if this was a college class, you could easily argue both sides pretty viciously.
I agree.
Actually.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I do think winter excluding, because that's just a completely different
animal.
Yeah, different animal. We're gonna just, you know, for the time being, just what we're in now, summer. What do you think the fine line between bold and stupid is? Because people go out solo all the time who are completely rationally equipped to go out hiking solo, myself, right? That doesn't exclude me that things can't happen to me. But there's people who are fine. They have the ability, the knowledge and stuff, but they get lost. And then there's people who don't get lost, but they get hurt, right? And for the most part, these people get out. It's not like someone broke their leg on Street Nye and then their body was found dead 3 days later. It's like that just doesn't happen. You know, they get rescued. People find out. They get, you know, and stuff like that. So I don't know. What do you think this fine line between bold and stupid is?
It's a great question. So I look back at my own 46er journey when I did Marcy Skylight Gray and I added Cliff and Redfield. That was both bold and stupid because I didn't know what I was actually getting myself into. I also look back at my own journey when I started too. You know, I didn't know, like I had like little note cards in my pocket of like trail junctions and where I'm going to turn and on the little notes written down from the map, because that's what the person who kind of, my buddy Josh, who took me through like, all right, here's how you hike in the high peaks. And that's what he did. So I did the same thing. I thought that's what everybody did. So there was a lot of stupid in my own first journey because, like I said, most of it was solo. But it's also, again, it was like you. It's just necessity. Like, not many people can go on Tuesday morning. And I have this goal that I'm trying to accomplish. So I'm not going to wait for other people.
Now, I will say sometimes, like, I know we can translate this to winter real quick. People will be like, hey, I want to go out this day. And then they have a hiking partner. And then they bail. But they still go anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to the lady who had to get rescued on Allen several years back in November. She wanted to go and finish her 46, but you know, her hiking friends couldn't go. So she decided to go solo anyway, and then ended up getting lost coming off the mountain. And so it's like, don't just be irrational with your choice. Like, oh man, my friends can't go, so I'm just going to go solo. Like, I think you have to figure out, like, at what point is it like, hey, I'm planning this. Do you want to come?
Mm-hmm.
Versus, hey, all my friends were all doing this. Oh, they can't do it. I'm just going to go do it anyway without them.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's like,
it comes down to, again, actually weighing the risk. And it's why I say it so much. The mountains don't care about you. You have to remember that and then weigh the risk. So let's take that woman, for example. Do you want to risk? Like, there was a reason that you're going hiking with these other people because you know, A, B, and C. Reason A, B, and C. They're not able to come anymore. So now you weigh the risk. Okay, if I go solo, knowing that things can go wrong, when I say the mountains don't care about you, it is in parentheses after, because things can go wrong out there. Even if you do everything right, things can go wrong. You slip on this one thing, boom, you know, dead or broken leg. You just have to weigh that risk. So, great, quick story. When I was one step from a massive fall on right. So I was guiding, and I was the guide. I was guiding people two winters ago now, I think, on right. You know when you're standing on the summit of right, how there's the big drop-off? like when you're actually on the summit, there's a huge like 10, maybe 15 foot drop. Yeah,
Torch Bolden?
Yes, correct. Yeah. I didn't have my glasses on because I don't wear my glasses when I have like goggles on, and it was so windy, you know, like that type of day on right.
In the clouds?
We weren't in the clouds. It was a sunny day. It was actually -0 or -30 on the summit. It was brutal. But I remember standing there. I was literally standing on the edge of that like drop without realizing it. Just because you're just up there with the people, like very innocently, you're just standing there looking around. All I had to do was turn around and take one step and I would have dropped 15 feet. But like very innocently, I very experienced in the mountains, but like, thank God I turned around and realized like, holy crap, that could have been bad if you're just not thinking, because things can go wrong even when you do everything right. Even when you have, you're prepared, you know what you're doing, the mountains don't care if things can go wrong. So you got to weigh the risks. And ultimately that is really what's going to determine what makes sense for you. But actually defining that for yourself and recognizing that, okay, am I willing to bear the consequences? Yes, things might not go wrong, but they might. So
I like what you said, that hiking with other people can competitively be just as dangerous as hiking solo, because now you have 1, 2, 3 more people. That's 3 or 4 times the amount of risk that someone can get injured. Now, I understand you're with them, higher likelihood getting pros attention faster. There's definitely pros and cons. But I think one of the main, you know, the takeaways,
it can be argued that it could be risky for just different reasons.
Yes. Yeah. So solo hiking is inherently dangerous, but not inherently reckless. Wait, no. Solo hiking is inherently, you know, dangerous, right? It's hiking.
Anything is.
Right? But it isn't inherently reckless.
I think that's a good way to put it. I would agree.
Risk exists with or without a partner. It just might look different.
And then you take the partner conversation. Yeah, if you and I have hiked many times together, so like we know, like it'll be, we know the type of day we're going to have. If you're going with someone you haven't, you don't know what type of day.
You and I need to go on a hike together.
We should.
Even if it's just Cascade, I don't care.
It's been a minute. We should. I actually got to go do the Dix Range soon, so we can go do the Dix Range. Do you need that this month?
No, I only need one more time.
What month?
January.
Ugh, gross.
But let me know in July, August, or whenever you go, because I'm gridded out past July, like July and forward.
Very cool.
Not everyone has the luxury of hiking with others, so life schedules don't align. People have different paces, goals, and comfort levels. Solo does not mean unprepared. Some of the most dialed-in hikers in the park are soloists who take safety seriously, and in fact, they don't even tell people where they're going. They're bushwhackers, and they just go and do whatever, but they have that knowledge base. They know how to survive in the woods.
They've accepted the risk to reward ratio. Like they have. I think of all of the people I know that are always off trail bushwhacking, every one of them is, yeah, they know what they're getting into. They're accepting it. And same thing with trail runners. You know, you take yourself, your trail runner, you take Bethany Gerritsen, you take people like them, like they're not going out with a backpack full of all this gear. Like they're going out to run.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have all the gear that everyone else has. They've accepted. And they're willing to bear the brunt of the
consequences. Trail running is definitely a good point.
If something goes wrong.
I know people who...
And they're so experienced.
People like... let's take like Ryan Adkins, for example. When he went to go get the Great Range Traverse FKT, these larger FKTs, people aren't even bringing med kits with them.
I know.
But that's just because that's what you got to do. You got to keep all the weight down. You just got to go for the time. And you're just like, hey, listen, something could happen to me. That's the risk here. But in order to achieve this goal, I have to go out under the assumption that nothing is going to go wrong in order to break this time. Now, that can totally sound reckless, but until you become an ultra runner, until you understand what the FKT world looks like, yes, I think a lot of people would say that, oh, that's dumb, at least bring little things. And I do for the most part. Like if I went and did a Bob Marshall FKT again, I would probably bring a couple things just in case I severely twist my ankle because it's not a lot of weight to take a bandage wrap and some tape.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it. It's just like you weigh the risk and you know what you're giving up for what you're trying to achieve. And sometimes if you don't know, you don't know. And if you can't put your mind in their mind, like you're never going to understand that. And it's kind of stupid to even try at that point. If you can't step back or like, you know, look down at this from 30,000 feet and see the bigger picture, and you're too like very detail rules oriented, you're never going to understand that. So why even try?
This argument will never, it won't ever help. It won't ever come to a conclusion. It won't ever cause someone to win one side or the other. Well, I think the only winning side
is arguments ever do.
Right. I think it's like, hey, just do your part. We're going to, you know, people will learn from their mistakes, and let's continue to advocate like knowledge, right?
And sometimes people are going to die from it. Like, let's just call it what it is. Like, that's going to happen. So we recognize that. So we recognize that that is the risk. And then sometimes the days are going to have zero problems whatsoever.
Right.
And everywhere in between.
I mean, there's what? Let's say on any given weekend, 1,000 people going out into the high peaks on a day. And some days, there's no problems. Yeah, I'm sure maybe a couple people were dehydrated, got out slower than they wanted to. You know, there's always the person who had the quote worst day in the woods, right? But that doesn't always translate that the rangers have to get called. So it's actually that often. I mean, how many people are hiking out a week in the summer? And we might have 3 incidences all week in the High Peaks Wilderness particularly. So that's a pretty good ratio. But tragedy doesn't prove stupidity. Just because something goes wrong doesn't mean someone was careless.
Agreed.
Life isn't a guarantee, and the wilderness doesn't offer insurance. And that said, don't romanticize it either. No summit is worth your life. Check the weather, leave a plan, know your gear, know yourself. That's it. Just a couple questions here asked by some listeners. These ones come from Genevieve. She asks where to stay or the best place to stay if we come from out of town, and are there places that welcome hikers for cheap, not necessarily hotels or Airbnbs? I tell people 2 places, and yeah, I'm sure there's a couple here that I'm just unaware about, but on the cheaper side for a hotel, I tell people Cascade Inn. But if you are just kind of like dirtbagging it and you're not looking for like a private room and stuff like that, go to T-Max and Topo's hostel. It's right near Lodge Road, and they got great rates. I think it's like $35 a night per person there, and they're super comfortable, super clean. David, who runs it, shout out to David. He does a phenomenal job. He's been here for decades running it.
People stay there all the time. I hear that that's like a lot of people that I know who come up here to hike, that's their go-to spot is T-Max and Topo's. They love it. They have nothing but good things to say. There's also campgrounds as well if you want a paid campground versus not, or versus a state campground. But yeah, T-Max is good. But just be aware, like it's like adult summer camp. Like you're in a room with a bunch of bunk beds. So if that makes you uncomfortable, the whole hostel vibe is probably not going to be for you. But just so you are aware.
Yeah. She's at 5 out of 46 high peaks, and she asks, is camping going to be a non-negotiable as I continue my journey? I would say no. Maybe 20% of people end up having to camp just because of their physical ability. That's probably the main thing, is it's either A, their physical ability limits them from being able to handle a 15-plus mile day, or B, they genuinely love camping and they just want to make an overnight trip out of it. So I would say as long as you pack right and you can stay consistent, and assuming you're not like, you know, morbidly out of shape, then you should be able to pull through pretty much anything in a day. And you can also like split stuff up. You don't have to go do Colvin, Blake, Nippletop, and Dial in a day. You can just do Colvin and Blake, Nippletop and Dial.
You could just do Colvin and then go back and just, well, technically you'll have to do Blake. Bad example. You could just do Dial, or you could just do Nippletop.
Yeah, because you have to go.
But yeah, I couldn't agree more. Also, if you, my book, The 46, or what is it called? The Adirondack 46 and 18 Hikes. That is all day hikes, because you don't have to camp. But in the book, I offer many places that, like, if you want to hike this range, this is a great range to camp on. Do it in 2 days. But you 100% don't need to. And don't feel that you have to finish the 46 in the normal route that people do.
Sure.
Because you can just go do 1 or 2 peaks at a time and make it what it is. And I think most people who know me know that I'm the biggest advocate for your physical ability matters most in what you're able to do. I think that's going to determine whether you camp or not. You don't have to, but it is fun if you like that, if you want to carry the stuff and like have that experience, because waking up in the Adirondack High Peaks in the morning is pretty awesome. It's a special thing. You hear the loons. Mm-hmm. You just kind of hear the birds chirping, that feeling.
It's
like
nice living here.
It is nice. It is nice.
How to find campsites in the Adirondacks. Okay, so I got 2 things. Easy, okay? A currently existing platform that is so underrated and not known is called Natural Atlas. I think it's the best resource online to scope out a map. and look at campsites, look at rivers, look at anything, because it's got a plethora of interactive and it's just such a good resource. So if you want to see campsites, all the lean tos and everything, check out Natural Atlas. It's free. All you got to do is just create an account. But then another resource that one day will totally, hopefully, blow that out of the water is going to be HikeDK.
Boom.
So you're gonna know everything. It's all going to be there. Last question, best hiking shoes. Totally dependent on the person, foot shape, experience. Are you carrying a lot of weight? How far do you go in a day? How often do you hike? How much money do you have? I think Salomon is a really well-rounded brand, but they are on the narrow side. If you have flatter feet, wider feet, definitely Ultras is a really popular one out here. I personally do a lot of my fast ultra hiking in La Sportiva. I really like La Sportiva, and La Sportiva has a lot of really great shoes, both trail running and backpacking. Again, they're on the narrow foot side. So when you're on the wider foot side, you can look at brands. There's a Solo, you can get Merrell, Keen. They're all entry level stuff. But I would say for the most part, look at the reviews. If a shoe is like higher rated than like a 4.5 out of 5 stars, then there's something to be said about that. Because that means it's getting put through stuff. I always look at the reviews, like what are people saying about it? And so look at that and see what about the shoe is doing that. Because like it could just be the grip and comfortableness, but then it could also be like, hey, I can hike for all day in this and not feel the shoe at all. That's what you want to go for. So look up several different, brands. And, I don't have a thing against Vibram rubber, but a majority of hiking shoes use Vibram, and I just feel like Vibram doesn't work well in the high peaks particularly. It's easy to slide on rocks, but a majority of brands use Vibram. La Sportiva uses their own VJ trail runner shoes, I think is the best grip in the world, but that is not for backpacking. But that's their motto, the best grip on planet Earth. It's butyl rubber, which is like car tire.
I have a lot of opinions on this shoe conversation, which I'm just going to quickly throw in because I mean, you probably get it. It's probably the most asked question that you receive from people too. It definitely is for me. It's like, what boots?
Well, I ask, what do you use? What do you, what are your goals?
Sure. But great way to start the conversation. My answer is always the answer no one ever wants when they ask a question, which is it depends, right? Like you don't know what this might fit well for your foot. The other shoe doesn't fit well. The other shoe fits well for someone else.
There's no magic cart
shoe. There is definitely no shoe. But see, when you said like check the reviews, like dude, you like one of the most popular trail shoe are the Ultra Lone Peaks and the Hoka Speed Goats. It's like there's always a conversation between the two. You go on there, you like there's
you're
still
find people who don't
people who hate them. Every second of all of them. Yep. And then there's people who swear by them. You just can't. Yep. You really in my what I always tell people is go into the whole buying shoe thing planning to return shoes, like go buy two or three pairs of shoes. You just deal with getting them, deal with shipping them back. Know you're going to have to walk around your house for a few days in them and actually figure out which shoe works. Obviously, if you go outside with them, you're not returning them anymore, but you can't know until you actually put some, at least feet, let alone miles on the shoe.
I would start with Salomon because they have a lot of stuff, and they also have they have certain shoes that they've made for wider feet. So you can stick with Salomon and have wider feet. But I think they really will tell you a lot about your feet. If you get a lot of blisters, this is a hot take of mine.
All right, let's hear it.
Blisters, if you have super soft feet and you start walking a lot, you're going to get blisters no matter what. Yeah. But if you are a good hiker, you've been hiking a lot, your feet are adapted to it, and you try a shoe on and you get blisters, it's not because your feet aren't used to it. It's because the shoe is not right for you. That's something I've learned. The amount of times I can put a new shoe on, something I've never worn before, a whole new brand, put it on and go do a 30-mile day, I'll feel nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's when you understand your foot shape, because then your foot is perfectly contoured to the shoe, and it's going to mitigate like the right shape, the right arch, everything. I think you can tell a lot by the shoe if it's right for you with how many blisters you get for it and where it's rubbing on your feet.
Sure.
So that's just something I've learned.
And immediately, I have found too over the years, this is both with my like hiking boots, my winter hiking boots, is the second your foot goes in that shoe if it's the right shoe or not. Like you just talked about, like, it feels perfect on your foot.
Right. There's not going to be little things. Like, if you notice something that you're like, oh, I don't know about that. Like,
I'm not sure. No, then you go, it's not the right shoe. And that's why I say, like, buy three or four and just plan to return them and just deal with, yeah, you're going to spend an extra $50 in returning shoes. But you know what? When you're out on the trail and you spent that extra $50 and your feet don't have blisters, you won't care. You'll be very pleased that you did what needed to be done. But so I've hiked in this Timberland hiking boot for most of my career here.
The same one?
Same boot. I've had eight or nine pairs.
I can only go 200 or 300 miles with the shoe at a time.
Well, I'm obviously not the same boot, but I've had like eight or nine pair of the same boot though. They're like $120. I get a new one every other season. But the second my foot went in that boot, I said, oh, this is perfect. This feels absolutely perfect. And then you get excited to go hiking because you only wear it when you're hiking and it feels great on your foot. With that said, I also then recently tried Trail Runners last year because I've been wanting to. And I put my foot into, I got some Ultra Lone Peaks because I love that wide toe box because I have wide feet. And the very second my foot went into it, I said, this shoe feels amazing. I want to wear it more. And I've hiked with it. I've felt great. I've not had any issues. And I knew, once again, the very second it went in, I knew it was the perfect shoe. So I do think there's something to be said about walking around, but there's also something to be said about if when you put your foot in it, you're just still like not entirely sure, it's probably not going to be the right boot or the right shoe.
Okay. We're going to get into, by the way, before we get into the next segment, if you're still listening, thank you so much. I hope we're entertaining to listen to, whether you're hiking right now. I know some people said they download their podcast and they listen to it when they hike, or if you're driving. I personally like the longer episodes because whenever I listen to a podcast, I'm always doing something that's really long. So I'm like, I'll listen to podcasts that are 3 hours long. That's just me. I know some people want to listen to shorter stuff to get some quick, good information.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
I'm the shorter podcast guy.
But hey, yeah, I like good conversation, especially if we're not just ranting and blah, 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 blah.
And hopefully you can feel that Adirondack connection as we record this right in the heart of Lake Placid, New York. May you feel that sense of the Adirondack vibe through your headphones right now as you listen.
All right. If you've been listening this far, thank you so much. We're just two guys rambling about the Adirondacks, but that's the purpose of this podcast. And hopefully it's been entertaining. I like the longer podcasts. Whenever I'm hiking or driving, it's for several hours. So I personally welcome the longer episodes. I know you like the shorter things, the short and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is fun. And as we go on and with more episodes, we're going to get different perspectives, different people on. And, if you have a show topic as well, something you want us to talk about, drop it in the comments below. With that, we're going to rapid fire the hot takes this week, like 10 seconds or less on each one. There's not as many this week, so this segment shouldn't be pretty fast. And then we'll get into Trailhead Trivia. All right. The trap tank ain't that bad. I think it's worse. You haven't been up yet.
I've never been.
In the summer, it's much more difficult than the winter, by far. Also, my friends trail ran Colden yesterday, and when they got past the trap dike entrance, they saw a guy halfway up there just staring at the waterfall like he didn't know how to get up it. So I don't know what happened to that guy. I think he was in a part where he was able to downclimb by that time, but he looked like he was just wearing a JanSport backpack and stuff like that. So the trap dike can absolutely be terrifying and bad, but I think it totally depends on who you are.
Probably go up the trap dike with someone who's been up it before successfully if you ever do go up the trap dike.
And don't wear sandals. All hikers leave their trace in some way.
Yep.
Duh. Yeah, for sure. This podcast needs to come out on a consistent weekly basis. Well, I mean, it's coming out like almost every single week. Sometimes it's 10 days, but sometimes I think the biggest thing is like I'm waiting for Hike 80K to be an actual active consistent thing where we can get consistent user feedback. That way we have a lot of things to talk about, because I think a lot of things on these podcast episodes are going to come from people who are using the platform actively.
Sure. And people want your podcast. So
yeah, there will be a podcast section on the website and within the app where you can submit anything to the podcast. Blake is the number one worst 46er. Hey, you know what? Blake is a rite of passage, as you've said.
Yes.
I think if you do Blake earlier on, it's going to seem worse than if you do it later in your journey.
It's not surprising that that's a hot take or that people kind of hate Blake, because it does take it. It's a coming of age mountain for your journey through 46. And it takes time away to appreciate the bigger picture of what Blake brings to the table, which is the 46er journey is supposed to be hard. And sometimes in life, you put all this hard work in for something that doesn't really quite have the payoff, but it builds grit. It builds, you know, all these other things within you. And that's really what Blake's purpose is, if you ask me, in terms of the 46.
Giant and Rocky Peak is a great introduction to hiking the high peaks. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely not like, when you say introduction to hiking the high peaks, like if you
not like have you haven't physical, ever hiked anything, but
if you have the physical ability to climb mountains, yeah, and you can handle it, yeah, totally. And it's a good representation of the Adirondacks, but I wouldn't, the word introduction makes me think like,
sure,
you should be on Mount Joe, not on Giant Rocky Peak.
Okay, this next one, I got a quick thing for it. Drone rules are too restrictive. Okay, here's what I think. If you look at the overarching rules in the Adirondack Park for drone usage, it's pretty much just wilderness areas.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple other restrictions elsewhere, but for the most part, it's wilderness areas. When you look at that and put that on the entire park, that's 20% of the entire park. So there are plenty of places you can use the drone. Now, most people who want to fly drones want to fly them in wilderness areas because that's where the most pretty things are.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand. But if you do your research enough, you can find loopholes not to fly them in wilderness. There is no loophole for that. But you can find places where there's wild forest, pretty beautiful locations that are right on the edge of wilderness zones. And as long as you launch and land your drone.
Exactly.
Right. Launch it and land it back in where you started outside of a wilderness zone. And you technically have to have eyesight of the drone, according to the FAA. Then it's totally fine. I mean, if you're able to somehow see the drone over Algonquin and you launched it from wild forest, then that's technically
legal. Yeah.
It's just like flying an airplane or driving a car.
It's just, you know, it's you got to kind of know what to do and know what you're looking for.
I don't think they're too restricted.
I agree. I think the amount of legal footage, and I have two different friends who are very knowledgeable and like they know everything about drone do's and don'ts here in the ADK. The footage that they have recorded that is completely legal is absolutely mind-blowing. So kind of know where to go.
I'd hike the out and back to Blake 100 times over. The out and back. I'd rather hike out back to Blake 100 times than out to Cuxhacaga once. You know what? If it's like,
I see the comparison.
If someone said, okay, you had to choose one of these for the rest of your life, hike the Blake or hike the Cuxhacaga, I'm going to hike the Blake.
Because
I got to go over Colvin. It's beautiful. The AMR Roadwalk is not really that terrible. I can go to Indian Head. You know, there's a lot of beautiful things to get the Blake. It's a gorgeous spot.
I was picturing more of like, when he said that, I'm picturing more of like going from Colvin to Blake and back to Colvin or from, Times Square to Cuxhacaga.
No, I do think Cuxhacaga is pretty bad. But however, it's
I would
like,
agree though. Blake,
I mean,
for sure.
I had to go get Cuxhacaga like by itself because I orphaned it the first time I went in there, and I was I wasn't happy about that. So I couldn't totally understand this hot take. This other person, Bob, says, "What is a hot take? Do people actually not know what a hot take is?"
Okay.
Come up with something controversial.
Your name is Brian Tuardi. Please turn your volume down while we tell you what a hot take is. Okay, Brian has turned his volume down. Hot take is just like an opinion that might be counter to what the general consensus of the world is.
Yeah.
It's a hot take.
I'd rather hike smaller, lesser known mountains because of less people in the summer.
Cool.
All right.
Have fun. They're great. I love the smaller mountains. I'm on, Jonathan at the beginning of the episode was like, hey, you haven't been in the High Peaks. I haven't been in the High Peaks, but I was up Joe and Van Hovenberg this week, like, I still get out there, but I find myself on the smaller mountains way more because they're just like quick and simple and I can go home and continue on with my day, get my mountain time.
Dude, that's like saying I'm having a salad with my meal to counteract the calories.
Most salads are higher calories than the actual meal. That's a hot take right there.
Ooh. The ADK will mold you as a hiker and make everything else seem easy. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear that pretty often.
And last hot take, Redfield is a top 10 high peak.
Top 10? Wow, that's a hot take. Let me think about that. So top 10, like it could be like number 10. Really?
Wow. Bottom 10.
I would put it, I mean, like definitely on the latter half of High Peak. So that I would, that's a hot take.
All right.
I'd love to know more, but yep.
Well, we're getting into the last segment, my personal favorite, especially when I'm with you. It is Trailhead Trivia. Now, James, you are the unlucky contestant on the show, mainly just because you're co-hosting with me here. And so you don't have to answer, but I want to see
I'm always going to answer.
I want to see what you think with some of these. And so if you're playing at home, There is no prize except for your pride and ego for your knowledge base in the Adirondacks. And I try to make these hard. In fact, this is the hardest segment for me to come up with every single week, because even though I feel like I'm filled with random fun facts, it's hard to turn them into trivia questions and to also not make them all about the High Peaks. All right, question number one. This first one is going to be multiple choice. Now, for those of you who obviously like hiking the High Peaks, there are four High Peaks under 4,000 feet. We know that. However, that's not the only criteria to make it a High Peak. It's not just a high point above 4,000 feet. It has to either be 300 feet of prominence or 3/4 mile from its neighboring mountain, right? So it's 4,000 feet and or 300 feet of prominence or 3/4 mile. However, there are a certain amount of mountains here that don't meet either of those. So they might be above 4,000 feet, but pretty much it's what I'm saying is how many Adirondack High Peaks do not meet the requirement to be considered a high peak at all? Is it A, 7, B, 9, C, 5, or D, 11?
I'm going to say C, 5.
The answer is B, 9.
Wow, that is an impressive statistic.
There are nine currently existing mountains that shouldn't be high peaks according to Bob's standards. That is Gray, Wright, Armstrong, Donaldson, South Dix, Blake, Cliff, Nine, Cuscarraga. Now, for those who heard Wright, you're thinking, what? Well, it's only 280 feet in prominence. Now, keep in mind, the prominence is 360 degrees around the mountain. So if you look it on the map at its lowest point of the col, which is not from where you start the hike up, you're hiking up a ridge, essentially. And so at the highest point there in that col is only 280 feet of prominence, and it's only 0.65 miles from Algonquin. So, and then obviously ones like Gray, Armstrong, Donaldson, South Dix, they just barely have any prominence, but they also don't meet the distance requirement. All right, that leads me to question number two. Out of all of the 46 peaks, how many of them fail to meet the 300-foot prominence requirement? So this, you know, some of these might be high peaks, but they only meet the distance and above 4,000 feet. So how many? Is it A, 7, B, 10, C, 12, or D, 16?
I'm going high, D, 16.
It would be 16 if you include Nye, Cuscarraga, Blake, and Cliff, right? But we're talking they hit 4,000 feet.
Yeah, they're above 4,000.
Right? So they're above 4,000 feet, but they just don't have the prominence. This is just prominence only. It would be 12, which is Gray, Wright, Armstrong, Donaldson, South Dix, Iroquois, Redfield, Panther, Upper Wolfjaw, Phelps, Emmons, and Dial.
I feel like at this point, we should all just drop all criteria for an Adirondack High Peak and just call them. There's a list of mountains. How do they, what qualifies them? The answer is just, that's just what they are. Like you just kind of,
they have the quality of a height.
You just blow past.
Yep.
Because there's too many fine details here.
Question number three, which one of these Adirondack peaks is named incorrectly due to a historical cartographic error? Is it A, Panther Mountain, B, McNaughton Mountain, or C, Henderson Mountain?
I'm going to say, because I have no idea where Henderson Mountain is, I'm going to say Henderson Mountain.
Henderson is by Lake Henderson. It's across the street from St. Anthony's. It's that big mountain that's right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Henderson Mountain. That's my guess.
You're correct. But it's also McNaughton and Panther. Huh. Trick question. It's all of the above. In a confusing turn of events, the USGS survey named all three of these neighboring peaks when producing the first full topo map of the area in 1904. And they completely got them all screwed up. Originally, today's Panther was McNaughton. Today's McNaughton was Henderson. And today's Henderson was Panther.
Well, there you go. Remember that day, that winter hike we did up McNaughton? I think I wanted to chop my knee off. I remember having a real tough time. That's all I think of when I hear McNaughton. I think about that rough trip out.
All right. Question number four. Which of these is the smallest named body of water in the Adirondack Park? Is it A, Thistle Pond, B, Raven Pond, C, Cedar Branch Pond, or D, Misty Brook Pond?
Dude,
what's your gut tell you?
Misty Brook Pond because it was the last one you just said. But I have no idea where any of those ponds are.
Actually, the correct the correct answer would be having no idea because it is none of these. All four names. Well, here's why.
Okay, there's all these trick questions.
Oh, yeah, hang on. All four of these names are fictional because that can't be determined. Like what's the smallest, what's named, and like what's the smallest one? Like, there's no real data about that, right?
Okay, good point.
So since there's a countless of even unnamed ponds that are like could probably be named, it's like, what's the smallest? Well, there really isn't one. So
good point.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just something that came up. All right, last question. You're gonna like this one. Which of these was the first town settled within the present day Adirondack Park? Is it A, Crown Point? B, Elizabethtown, C, Northville, or D, Lake Placid?
My gut says Crown Point A.
The correct answer is none of the... No, I'm just kidding. Crown Point, yes. Site of Fort St. Frederick, whose construction began in 1734 and later organized as the town of Crown Point in 1788. And that's the wrap of trivia, and that's the wrap of the entire show. Hikey Decay is still gunning for a full release soon. Soon could mean anything, but if you want to know the second it drops, make sure you're following us on Instagram at Hikey Decay, or better yet, sign up for the emails at our website, hikeydecay.com. That's also where you'll find how to submit your hiker stories, questions, and for the show. As well as if you have a hiker story, a really beautiful story you want to share with us, a long story, a frightening story, whatever it is, just submit it to us at our email at contact@hikeydecay.com, or if you want to share anything about the show at all. And of course, this massive giveaway is coming up where you're going to be able to have an all expenses paid pretty much trip to Lake Placid, lodging, food, even a $300 gift card to High Peak Cyclery. So, James, do you have anything?
Yes, if you want some help getting in better shape so that you can enjoy your mountain adventures this summer, I have a Great Range Athlete 6-week program starting July 6th. These programs are awesome. They'll help you get in shape so that you can enjoy yourself out there, and the physical fitness won't be a problem for you when you're out hiking this summer. GreatRangeAthlete.com.
So never forget, the Adirondacks will only stay forever wild if we choose to keep them that way. Explore them, love them, and protect them, because the more we give back, the longer we get to keep forever exploring the forever wild.